Blog Talk Radio.
You're my sunshine, you brighten my day. Cause you're all my soul fire, yeah, you brighten my day.
Been around the world, played a lot of games. It's been the depth of my heart, you the one to blame. I'm looking deep into your eyes, I can see the future. Ain't no me without you, and that's a damn truth. You got me pouring out my heart in this fucking booth. And you're just like Kendrick with a sweet tooth. A little bit of you, just wonders for the soul. The better half of me will never grow old.
You're my sunshine, you brighten my day. Cause you're all my soul fire, yeah, you brighten my day.
A dark night like this, I really need you here. I'm lost without you. Come and save me, dear. My superwoman in my life, ain't no need to feel. The brightest thing in the world, let your little light shine. One of a kind, I'm really glad to say you're mine. You're the only one that keep the inner beast in line. My time will never be wasted with you. With you, it's always something to do.
You're my sunshine, you brighten my day. Cause you're all my soul fire. Yeah, you brighten my day.
Sunshine, you make everything better.
I had to bring mom in on this one.
Anybody grateful for God's blood?
Tell them about it, mom.
Oh, the blood that saved me, the blood that raised me, the blood that healed me.
Yes. Listen.
Saved my life.
And thank you for the lamb.
Thank you for the lamb. Oh, the lamb that was sacrificed.
All right, everyone. You're listening to Show Talk with Angela Butler. Today, the interview is with Mr. David Barr III. Mr. David Barr has an illustrious career, extremely talented gentleman and playwright. Theater. He's wrote for Ebony Magazine for 16, 17 years. He has numerous playwrights, numerous coveted prestigious awards for his theater play. Mr. David Barr, he's been a visitor all around America as an actor, a writer, and producer since 1986. As an actor, Mr. David received a Joseph Justice Citation, acted a principal role for his portrayal of Philip Mobutu in the critically acclaimed drama Victims at the Organic Theater Greenhouse in 1992, and prestigious Joseph Jefferson Award for Best Ensemble in 1998. The Death of Black Jesus, and so many more. He's Black Caesar. He portrayed the new play Black Caesar, was the first play in this particular series for Chicago's Columbia College. It was sponsored by, chosen for publication by Performing. Its world premiere was at Pegasus Players in February 2007. It's just amazing. He's just an amazing gentleman. You're in for a treat. He also wrote A Revival State of Mississippi versus Emmett Till, was reshaped in September 2003 to commemorate the 25th anniversary season of the Pegasus Players, the 1999 dramatic stage play, then retitled as The Face of Emmett Till, made in Southern Jubilee at Dillard University. When I talked to you, Mr. Barr, Mr. David Barr III, you talked so eloquent about Miss Till. Miss Mobley Till. beautiful words. Surprising, some of it, but understandable as a woman.
See, well, first of all, thank you. I really appreciate that wonderful, wonderful intro. It just makes me feel old, you know, but very blessed.
Worked on something April of 2022.
Yes.
At the American Theater in Hampton, Virginia.
Yes.
And Us For Us had its world premiere in 2022 at the American Theater in Hampton, Virginia in 2022.
Yeah, it's been an incredible journey. That was a movie called The Abingdon Gardens 158, built for us, by us, and about the historic Abingdon Gardens neighborhood down in Virginia. And we got a bit of a Smithsonian grant from that, with the as well as the African American History Foundation, who were just incredible to us, very, very kind. But of the blessings that I've gotten, and I've gotten a lot, you know, I mean, I've gotten a lot, you know, a lot of people don't understand. When God sends the blessings, the blessings ain't to you. The blessings are supposed to come through you. And that's exactly what I've been able to do. But one of the biggest blessings that I've ever, ever gotten in my professional career was just meeting Mamie Till Mobley, let alone the incredible honor of working with her and getting to know her and having dinner with her, laughing and crying with her, and then eulogizing her at her funeral. It's been an amazing 25 years since the face of Emmett Till first opened. As you mentioned, The State of Mississippi versus Emmett Till, that was his first title. And it opened on September the 4th, 1999. I cannot believe it's been 25 years. The main thing I can't believe is Mrs. Mobley's been gone 22, because I swear to God, well, 21 now, 21 years. And I swear to God, I feel like I've talked to her every day. I mean, it just changed my life, totally changed my life. She was as close to me as any non-relative, but I don't even think of her as not kin. She just became that much a part of my soul. And that was the same with anybody that ever met her. Anyone that ever met her was forever changed by meeting that lady, just for a couple of minutes, just for a couple of minutes. And I happen to know her for almost a decade, so I'm feel very blessed.
I feel very blessed. You said some things, and I don't know. Do I have your permission to talk about some of these things?
Yeah, we're here now. Yeah, I mean, it's just us, right? Yeah, of course, you can talk about it.
before today,
yeah.
The things you said, the shocking thing you said about when you walked into her home, her and her husband's home.
Right. The first time I had met her in negotiations, just for the benefit of your audience, I had been in negotiations with her and her lawyer and, you know, a few more folks and other, because she had been approached, as you can imagine, through decades and decades and decades of people who wanted to tell that story. And everybody had their own twist and own spin, and she just wasn't digging it for whatever reason. And I'm not going to, the names are too numerous to talk about the people that she turned down. But for some bizarre reason, she said she'd give me a shot. And so I'm all ready to rock and roll over there. And so when we got everything agreed, we signed off on everything, I'm on my way over there. I get up to the front door, and I'm going to tell the story. We're going to tell the story. We're going to show them. I'm all ready to rock and roll. And Mr. Mobley, Eugenie Mobley, her husband of I don't think they made 45 years. That's right, I don't think they made 45. They were almost there. But they were about he opens the door, as he always did, big old smile, tall, strapping man. And I'm ready to rock and roll, and he opens the door, and there's a room full of white people. And I said, am I in the right house? And he started laughing. He said, man, come on in here. And what had happened was, these were a group of missionaries who had befriended Mother Mobley through her Kojic faith and different spiritual journeys that she would have, you know, pilgrimages and things. She'd go to their place, they'd come to her place. But they're on their way to a conference in Milwaukee, and they wanted to they just called to ask her, they come over and say prayers with her and sit with her and have fellowship with her. And And the whole idea of in my head changed about what that play could and should be about. Maybe that's why we get along so well. So her thing was, because Emmett was so personal, and what happened to him was so personal to everybody, especially if you're an African-American, and especially if you're a black male or if you're a black mother. So either you're a black man or you're a black woman who is a mother. It's so personal that everybody had their specific take on what she should be feeling and what she should do about what happened to her son. And they were all wrong. She had a totally different feeling about everything, almost everything, that a lot of other people felt. Not because they weren't justified in feeling angry and vengeful and embarrassed and humiliated and livid and vitriolic and whatever. But her thing was, that's not going to bring Emmett back. I want to have fellowship and reach across the aisle and have love, because I want to try to prevent another Emmett from happening. And I don't want anyone else being killed in the name of my son, trying to get vengeance or revenge for him. And it totally transformed my idea about what that play should be about. That play automatically became, and it got away from being David Barr's story or David Barr's agenda. It became exactly what it was, a mother, a beautiful mother, who loses a beautiful boy, her only child, in the most horrific way. So you watch an ordinary person perform extraordinarily because of her faith. That's what the story was, and that's what no one before me had come along had understood. Now, I'm not saying, again, I'm so much better than those people. I just automatically got it immediately when I saw that thing. And from that point forward, we were on her agenda. We were on her time. And that's why, because, you know, being open to her story transforms you, because that's who the woman was. And that's what she wanted us to know her son was. Her son wasn't a martyr. Her son was murdered. His son was murdered. He wasn't assassinated. He was killed. He was dismembered for nothing other than hatred. But she wasn't gonna fix and conquer hatred with more hatred. She won't try to do that through love. And that's what she did. That's what she did for the rest of her life. That's what I want people to know about Ms. Mobley. So I'm sorry, I didn't want to get off on another tangent, but that's the first time on our first day of working together on The Face of Emmett Till, the play that's gone halfway around the world now. That our first day working together, that's what I encountered before I sat down, a room full of white folks on the south, on the black south side of Chicago. Okay. You know.
All right. So Mr. Emmett Till was murdered at 14 years old, am I correct?
Yes.
It was horrible.
He had just turned 14, actually. He just turned 14 a month earlier.
It was horrible to wait. And he allegedly whistled at a white woman, said something to a white woman. Am I correct?
Well, that's been disavowed even by the person. But shortly before she passed, I guess she wanted to make sure she was going to, wherever she thought she was going, she wanted to come clean. So that was, and Mrs. Mobley, just so you know, Mrs. Mobley, Mother Mobley never, ever, ever believed that, because she knew her son. Just like they were telling her that wasn't his body, and then when he was exhumed, you know, for DNA analysis, of course that was proven that it was her son, as she had been telling people all along. Carolyn Bryant, the woman he allegedly whistled at, totally disavowed that happened, which is exactly what Mrs. Mobley has said for years. Never happened. Never happened. She just did that just to make the husband jealous, because the husband was a womanizer and a philanderer and brazen about him. She just did that to make him jealous. That's all that was. That's all it was. And much to her credit, quote unquote, she did say that, but much to her discredit, she allowed the entire world for 60, almost 70 years to believe something that was totally based on a lie.
Totally based on that. Poor Mr. Emmett Till could be alive.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. And, you know, the beautiful thing, it's interesting you said that, because one of the things, one of the major tragedies about what happens to young black children, young black poor people, young children anywhere, anyone who gets taken away from us so horrifically and so senselessly, like Mrs. Mobley would always say, she said, how do you know Emmett wasn't going to be the one to cure cancer or AIDS or build the first rocket ship, you know, the first manned ship to go to Mars? In that era, we were talking. How would you know he wouldn't have been the first black president? Well, you know, at that particular point, there was no Obama. Okay, you don't know anything of what he could have done, but now we'll never know because of something so senseless. So it's interesting that you would say that. I mean, she was an incredible thinker, beautiful, beautiful woman. Ms. Mobley was probably about 4'11", maybe 5 foot in heels. Okay, but when she walked in the room and she started speaking, she was Shaquille O'Neal. Okay, she was so towering. Her presence was so magnetic. She was this sweet. She had a very soft, pronounced, and very clear. She loved to laugh. A lot of people always look at her as some poor, mournful person, always sorrowful, whatever. No. She was a joyful person because she was in the spirit. You know, she loved the Lord. Obviously, the Lord loved her and her family because they kept her and took her to places she would have never gone before. And much to her credit, she felt like she needed to do that to live two lives. And she did. But she's absolutely right. Her thing was, I'm living for Emmett now because of all the things that he could have been.
Yes. Of all the things he could have been.
Mm-hmm.
And the part about segregation and racism, even though Ms. Mobley was in the spirit, was a godly person, a spiritual person, a saved person when she lives, that's the sad part about racism.
Yes.
And
I mean, it's one of those things where it's so senseless, but used to – the only thing it's used for is to gain power and sway over someone. If it wasn't racism, if racism wasn't able to be used to subjugate someone else so you can have domain over them or dominion over them or power over them, there'd be no uses for racism. So it would have to be something else. Hair, what kind of car you drive, what color your tires are. But it's been a useful tool in colonialism and through the years in terms of the caste system and classism and whatever to get and gain power. The only reason why out of that house that night was to show everybody else in the area, this is what we can do to you at any time. We can put the button on you at any time we bloody well feel like it. That's the only reason why. And they wanted to make an example of them because they wanted to maintain sway over all the local blacks in the area. This is what happens when we think you're stepping out of line. And to this day, to be very candid with you, to this day, there's still areas down in Greenwood and Money and Sumner County and all that. There's still areas where if you say his name, black people start to shy away. So they use the method very effectively, but it's insidious and disgusting on its face, of course.
Yes, it is. And black people do shy away when you said Mr. Emmett Till's name. It's because, you know, in some places they still hang black people, so.
That's exactly right. And she was out there with them, too. She was the mothers. I think we spoke about this just for your audience's sake. I tell people all the time, Mrs. Mobley, she wasn't an ambulance chaser. She wasn't a headline chaser or none of that stuff. She only wanted three things. Three things that woman wanted. Three things that she wanted. Her son was so cruelly taken from us, and then the state just so ludicrously allowed the admitted killers to go free without serving a half a day in jail. She wanted an apology from the state of Mississippi. She wanted someone to pay for a newly done marker for his gravesite that she wanted, and she simply wanted her phone to stop ringing every year, or at least once or twice a year, because something had just happened to someone else's child that reminded them of the killing and the murder of Emmett Till. And I told you, you know, when we first spoke, she never got any one of those three in her lifetime, and that's a doggone shame.
Oh,
that's
I haven't.
A doggone shame. Never.
Her phone never stopped ringing with somebody having been murdered, a girl, a man, a woman, a child, a teenager, black female, teenager.
I mean, it rang, and sadly today it would probably ring once or twice every week, and that would make her very sad. But her phone always rang at least once or twice a year, she said, because someone would call her from some place, somewhere around the country, saying, hey, your so-and-so was just killed. Did you know about that, Mrs. Mobley? Does that remind you of what happened to your son? I mean, that's how the conversation would start. And her thing was, if my phone stops ringing, maybe that means that somebody's child has been saved. Somebody's child. Black, white, young, old, gay, straight. But in particular, though, her thing was, I just want to stop the systematic killing of young black children. And hopefully that's a sign of us coming back, or coming to, at least, because we haven't really ever gotten there, coming to some sort of equanimity amongst classes and races. Because her thing is, I mean, her thing when Emmett was slaughtered and murdered so cruelly, her thing was, she thought it was the worst thing that ever happened to anybody in this country. Not because it was just her Emmett. That was hard enough as it is. But her thing always was, and she says it all the time. She says it in our play, but she would say it in interviews. She'd say, once you actually sign off on killing so cruelly and ugly and blatantly black children, or our children, period, then it's open season. Because if you can take the most precious thing away and the admitted killers are allowed to go scot-free, and what else? You can take anything. You can pretty much, you just open up the gates. It's like open season on black people. You know, we've totally lost any sense of humanity or any kind of justice. And it's just going to get worse, and it's going to continue to cascade to get worse. And she was right. She was right.
Yeah, in the way black people are being killed in the street. Like, you know, the blood is running through the streets. So I know you were an Ebony magazine writer, worked for 16, 18 years.
Yes, ma'am.
Theater plays and played in her prestigious awards. And I can't go on and on about David Marr III. But they're killing black people, sir.
Yeah.
They're imprisoning them.
Yep.
There's a gentleman right now named Fabian Dante Scott who's in jail in Dumont, Texas for 4 years and no trial.
Well, we still got people like the murderers and the cover up behind people like Sandra, speaking of people like Sandra Bland. We still got people down in that part of Texas who have still never spent one day in jail for the murder and the cover-up of that situation. I mean, it's amazing how many of these folks have gotten away scot-free. Some of them have gotten promotions. Some of them have gotten promotions.
They usually get promoted.
Absolutely. But they doggone sure never do jail. Very rarely do they ever see the inside of a jail cell.
Are
very
you
rarely.
Surprised at the number of black people in Texas?
In Texas,
yeah.
one of the things that Mrs. Mobley was, I don't know.
They can't kill us all, but when they get an opportunity, they do kill us.
That's what happens. I mean, that's what happens, and they do it so callously, and that they've watered down the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department, Department of Justice, for so many years now. It's like it doesn't even exist anymore. And so you don't have anywhere to go. And literally, that was one of the things that Mrs. Mobley tried to do in 55. She couldn't even get the Department of Justice for the United States or even the state of Mississippi to hold those men who admitted that they kidnapped that boy from his house. Now, even though they admitted that they killed him and they got off so they couldn't get tried again for double jeopardy, they didn't try him for kidnapping. And the state refused to bring charges against them the entire time that they were still alive. And they admit that they kidnapped them. That was 70 years ago almost. They're still getting away with stuff like that right now. Breonna Taylor in Louisville, that guy who authorized that unauthorized raid that ended up and resulted in her getting a bullet in her head, okay, that beautiful social worker, beautiful nurse, paramedic, she gets killed, he not only is not going to do any time, he's still getting his benefits. That happens to us. That's happening to us. It's continuing to happen to us. And I don't see it stopping. And that's why I wanted to speak so so lengthily about it, and I apologize about Mamie, because one of the things that people never understood is Mrs. Mobley had a big life after the killing of her son, and some of her causes were prison reform. I know that you've been really speaking out highly on that, because I know that you've had some interviews and things about the Innocence Project and prison reform through the years, and I just applaud you, sister, for doing that. You stuck to your guns. You stuck to your guns, you know, and it's beautiful. But people like Mamie's done it too.
Miss Mamie did it first.
Well, but let me tell you, but she would be so proud knowing that sisters out here like you ain't doing it just as a one-off, or, you know, I need to get my clicks up or my ratings up. This is you can't do what you're doing. Come on, you can't do what you're doing unless you believe in what you believe in. You can't. So I applaud you, sister. I applaud you.
I know that there have been lynchings in my area where I live at.
Mm-hmm.
That were called suicides, and there have been people who have been drowned, and it was called an accidental drowning.
Mm.
Called, and all those things. So, see, I understand racism. I don't
mm-hmm.
hate people, and if I hated white people, I wouldn't be able to function.
Right.
Because everywhere.
Right. And that's another thing that Ms. Mobley said. She was like, I can't.
A white man just in my house fixing my dishwasher. So if I hated white people. Yeah,
well,
I would let them near me, or I wouldn't want them in my house. I wouldn't want them in the store where they're
right.
working at or anything like that. So you can't, if you hate them, if you hate like that, You're not going to be able to function. I know some people used to get upset by Roots, the original Roots,
right,
the movie,
right.
when it came on.
Right.
And if you, and they couldn't, and they had to work with white people the next day. So, you know, Mr. Alex Haley.
Right.
So, I mean, you can't, if you hate them like that, you're not going to be able to function as a female.
Well, I know that. Yeah, you couldn't be more right. I know one of the things I think you and I spoke about it when we first spoke, one of the things I think I mentioned to you with Ms. Mobley, she, you know, because I had a, just like she did, you know, when she first heard that Emmett was found, she said she didn't fall out or anything like that. You know, she believed she had a vision. And, I mean, pretty much she believed that God came to her. And she said, you know, I wasn't trying to be chivalrous. I was mad. I had a bunch of angry questions. I was like, wow, how can you have this? This is my only child. I'm not going to have another child. You know, I've done everything you asked me to do. I walked in the way. I've been in the spirit. And the voice told her, you're making an assumption that Emmett was yours. Emmett was mine. And I sent him to the earth for a job to do. And he's done that job well. Now it's your turn. Now you have work to do. And like she said, if I had those thoughts, I would have been dead the night that voice came to me, because I was just so overcome with grief and whatever. Now, remember, she hadn't even seen him yet. All she knows is that he was found and he was drowned. That's all she knows at that time. But she's like, I would have died, because I would have been consumed with guilt and anger and frustration, because I didn't have any recompense. I didn't have any retribution. There's no way I was going to get them to give him back to me the way I sent him down there, number one. And number two, I knew I would never get justice. I've got to be able to work in another way to try to prevent another Emmett Till from happening. And she said she made a commitment to the voice and to God that night that I'm going to do everything I can, to spend every waking moment I can, making sure that I absolutely, when I close my eyes, have done everything I could to prevent that, whether that's working with whoever it takes, white people, black people, old, young, male, female, whoever. And that's what she did. That's what she did. She said, because I couldn't let it consume me. It would have not only taken Emmett, but it would have taken all that he stood for, all God sent him for. And then it would have taken me, and then I would have let both of them down, God and her son. She really felt that. And if you talk to her, you felt it, because she believed it so much. And, you know, if you look at her career, the voice was right. The voice told her, "For this one I've taken, I will give you thousands." She didn't understand what that meant. She was a secretary, worked for the U.S. Air Force, downtown Chicago. She, what does that mean? She winds up becoming the last roving public school teacher in Chicago public schools. And thousands, I mean thousands of kids came to her classroom through the years. That's what the voice meant. She had no intention on being a school teacher. And all of a sudden, it just came to her. So she's had to caucus with different people, people who did not look like her. And she had to learn. And by doing that, she actually helped teach me as well, you know, that I need to be looking at it bigger. Not that I got to like it, but that you got to understand it and understand and be able to use it for some positive, make something good come out of it. And that's what she did. So that's what I tried to do.
Is that why she opened the casket, Miss?
Yeah, because one of the things that she said was nobody's ever going to believe her. Nobody. You know, and the play, when I first said, one of the things, the way we started was, I said, just tell me the story. Turn the paper corner on, I just let her talk. It was bright, sunny day, early that day when I got there, okay? By the time she finished, it was pitch black night and the crickets were chirping. And I'd run out of tape hours earlier. What she saw coming out of that casket, as she continued to tell everybody, was 10 times worse, 10 times worse than what we saw or that she could ever describe to anyone. No one was going to believe her. But she knew that if she did not show that, let the cameras come in. In particular, it was Jet Magazine and the Chicago Defender. Let them take those pictures. Nobody would ever believe them. So then once people got the pictures, she was inclined to say, no. We got thousands of people out here that want to see this. Let the people see what I saw. So that's why she decided to have the open casket. But she wanted it to be ingrained in everyone's mind. This is the face of hatred. This is what hatred can do.
That's what it is, and
I'm telling you, I literally put that story in that play, in our play, word for word how she told it to me. And we've had people running out of that theater, especially children, young folks. I mean, we try not to make them too young, but you know, one of the reasons why it impacts teenagers so much is because in it, like she said, was a teenager.
And they need to know.
Oh my God, we've had people. Oh yeah, it's been rough, and we, especially when we have the schools come in, we tell them, hey, look, this is not going to be, you know, this isn't a Disney version, you know, we're not going to homogenize this. We're going to tell the story exactly how the story happened, you know. So if you can't take that, then you can just read something or see something else. But this is her story. This is her play. This is her vision and her memories, and her memory was rock solid. And it's been proven right, so yes.
All right. So you wrote for Ebony Magazine also, sir?
Yes, ma'am. I wrote for Ebony Man Magazine for 4 years. I worked for Ebony Magazine in the marketing department for almost 20. And so I had to do double duty there for about 4 or 5 years, but I definitely enjoyed it. And while I was working at Ebony Man, that's when I met Mother Mobley, and I got very fortunate. I got a chance to talk to some incredible people. I'm just incredible people through the years. You know, a lot of celebrities, a lot of stars. Some of them sadly aren't here anymore, but working for John H. Johnson, who's the founder of Ebony and Jet magazines, a country boy from Arkansas City, not far from where Bill Clinton was born and raised. He was yet another icon, another figure that just absolutely transformed my life. He was an incredible pioneer and trailblazer who doesn't get any of the due that he's due. Just a powerful titan. It was an honor. I mean, literally, it was a history class. Every day he opened his mouth when I was around him, and I tried to be around him as much as possible, you know, but he taught me a lot. He really taught me more, as if I didn't already, how to respect and understand our history and how to promote our ancestry, you know, in a way that we're to be seen. not making it up, just telling the story as it is. And that's what he did when he started with the Negro Digest and then into Ebony and then into Jet Magazine. And then, of course, Ebony Man later in the 90s, in the 80s and the 90s.
Yes. Ebony Magazine was a great magazine.
It was the first time you saw black models. I mean, a lot of people don't even understand just how revolutionary it was. Before the Negro Digest and Ebony and Jet Magazine, remember now, TV was just coming out. You never saw black people on billboards or in magazines or in newspapers modeling some of the high fashion stuff. Never, ever on a national scale. You might have seen them in local newspapers, but not on a national scale. And Jet Magazine and Ebony Magazines were the first ones to do it. And then Ebony Fashion Fair with the cosmetics and the tour. I mean, the man just did some amazing things. So between John H. Johnson and Mamie Till Mobley, I couldn't go wrong.
Miss Mamie Till Mobley sounds like a great woman. What do you think about what President Biden did?
Which one? Which thing?
President Biden with the family. I interviewed his cousin.
Wheeler?
They're suing.
Which cousin? I'm sorry. I don't know which one.
Sterling. Attorney Bleak Shabazz is representing them. They're suing because they found the paperwork saying that about, you know, she should have been arrested. Paperwork, a warrant for her arrest, and she died before she could be arrested. But
I'm hoping that this is just my hope. I'm hoping that because I'm one of those cats that is I believe that every Nazi or any person complicit in World War II and the Holocaust and everything should be hunted down until we can prove every piece of their ashes are in the grave some kind of way. If there's anybody living and breathing who is complicit in the Holocaust, and I don't care if they're 1,000 years old, they should be held up to justice. I feel the same way for the Kellos, for Emmett Till. All right? Anybody that was complicit, and there were, from what it looks like with more investigation, a lot of those men and some of those women who knew the truth, a lot of them are still alive. They're like in the 80s and 90s now, you know. A lot of them are much younger. But, look, the woman just died, and she was what? She was in the late 70s, early 80s, but she's still alive. She was still alive. You had plenty of time to at least arrest her for perjury. At least you could have done that. But that didn't happen. So I'm all down for hunting everybody in there who even remotely is walking. I don't care if they're on oxygen and an iron lung in a nursing home right now, okay? I don't care if they're giving them 5 seconds to live. They should be indicted or sued and held accountable for literally torturing that family for the better part of 70 years. Yes, I'm 1,000% for that, okay? You know, I don't believe that.
What did they do to the family?
Huh?
What did they do to them?
Well, what's happened is when you withhold justice, you know, you withhold the opportunity for them to get some kind of justice in terms of them being able to identify this person as being complicit in the death of their loved one. In this particular case, I'm speaking specifically about Emma now, but I mean, there are tons of other cases out here like that where they think there's some kind of statute of limitations. Oh, that was so long ago. Oh, those people are old now. Oh, they're not going to hurt anybody. No. No, they were complicit in this hate crime, this thing happening that totally transformed our family. They should be held accountable. Did they perjure themselves? Did they withhold evidence? Did they try to shoo someone away from testifying? Those things happen. It happened all around the trial for Emmett Till. And if those people are alive, they should be held accountable. So you wound the family because they were not able to live their lives in peace. You took one of their major family members away. And then there's just the disgrace of people thinking, okay, this little boy, fast talking or whatever, he whistled this white woman. Come to find out the white woman said it never happened. So that's so you've defamed him and his name and his reputation through all of those years on something that never happened. It never happened. She says it never happened. So yeah, she should have been indicted. Of course, at least on perjury charges. At least on perjury charges. That should have happened. So I'm 1,000%. I don't believe in statute of limitations for murderers or complicity.
I did an interview with Ms. Priscilla Sterling and Mr. Barlett. Her name was Miss the white lady name was I'm trying to think of her name. I can't believe I forgot that lady's name.
Oh, you mean in the Emmett Till case, Carolyn.
Carolyn Sterling.
Yes.
No, that wasn't Carolyn Sterling. Priscilla Sterling was his cousin that I interviewed, Miss Sterling.
Okay.
Miss Carolyn, oh my God, I'm embarrassing myself.
Well, we know you're talking about.
She lied.
Yeah.
She lied.
Yes.
She lied. She lied and said that he whistled at her or something, and it never happened.
It never happened. It never happened. But my point is, that set in motion and a total line of hate and vengeance,
Carolyn,
that should have never happened.
Her name was Carolyn Bryant Doe, and she died at 88. Her words doomed Emmett Till.
Yes.
Miss Mamie Till Mobley. She just destroyed Emmett Till.
Yes. I mean, when she started that set the whole chain of events in motion. Like you said, she just died. Before she did that, she told, of course, a white author, but she told this author that she made the whole thing up. Which is exactly what Mrs. Mobley had been saying for 50
that's
years.
What she had been doing for years to get.
She said it. That's what she said. She said it for 50 years.
But back then, they did it back then. Often white women did. They said they were raped.
Yeah.
They were cheating on their husbands. They said they were raped by a black man. They've been molested by a black man instead of their father or their brother or their cousin. I mean, so.
So it was easy for them to get away with that lie because the myth and the stereotype had been perpetrated for decades and decades and decades before that. So it was easy for her to shoot that BS out of her mouth and the entire county believe it. So, yeah, they should be suing, and, yeah, they should win. Her family should be – I don't care whether she's in the grave right now. Her family should be made to pay and put some reparations and some kind of compensation for defaming Emmett and Mrs. Mobley and their whole family in general. So I hope the lawsuit goes forward, and I hope they win. I'm supporting them 1,000%.
Yes, sir. I understand that you're supporting them 1,000%. Mm-hmm. And I blame for that. I support them, too, even though I only had to be with Ms. Priscilla Sterling. I used to interview with attorney Malik Shabazz, but that hasn't happened recently or lately.
Mm-hmm.
I've did 7-8 interviews with Mr. Malik Shabazz, attorney Malik Shabazz.
Okay.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
Trayvon Martin, Mr. Little Trayvon Martin, teenager, 17-year-old Trayvon Martin. Black men don't like to be called boys at all.
Right.
So I'm going to call him teenager, Mr. Trayvon Martin. Because when you call them that, it comes from slavery and segregation, the white man, the white woman calling them that and spitting. But black women are discriminated against also. Black women are. What would she have said about Trayvon Martin being compared to her son?
Well, I can tell you, because that happened a little bit after she passed, but I can tell you what she did with similar cases and people that she supported through the years, what she would have said. First and foremost, the first thing she probably would have done was try to get his mama on the phone, because Ms. Mobley's family was very much in touch with Mothers for the Movement. They were very much in tune with them. And one of them was Trayvon Martin's mother, of course, who was part of that. But Mamie would have been leading the charge out there with the marches and supporting her and being wherever she needed to be for the trials, because that's the kind of woman she was. One of the, again, like I said earlier in our conversation here, one of the things that she wanted most of all was her phone not to ring, because for 1 year, just give her one good year where her phone's not ringing because somebody or something similar has happened to a young black boy out here who was unjustly killed because of the color of his skin, and someone who wanted to practice this, to have sway over them, have domain over them, to try to dehumanize them, to marginalize them. And that's exactly what happened that night with Trayvon Martin in Sanford, Florida, right outside of Orlando. I know that town very well. I did some work in Orlando and Daytona.
So I know
your state very well, and Florida sadly has a long history of those kinds of unjustified homicides, and usually black folks at the end of a rope.
South, yes, the land is here.
Yes.
And all those amusement parks are still here, but it's still the South, Florida.
Killing ground. It's still a killing ground. You're absolutely right. So to answer your question, Mrs. Mobley, Sunshine State, no, she would have been right down there, right behind Trayvon's mother and the father and that family, in full support. If her health was up to it, she would have been on the first plane down there to support her. I definitely made sure she got on the phone and writing articles or giving interviews or anything she could to offer her condolence and her support. That's who she was, man. That's who she was.
Great.
Oh my God! One of the saddest things about her, and I'm not downing any of the women of the movement, like the Coretta Kings and the Merle Everses and the Rosa Parks. These are queens, absolute queens. Fannie Lou Hamers, and I could go right on down the line, But one of the people that sadly is sorely missing from that Mount Rushmore is Mamie Till Mobley. Just an incredible presence, an incredible woman, an incredible heart. And the world really lost something on January 6th in 2003 when Miss Mamie passed. She was on her way to the King Center. She was on her way to the King Center the next day to support a documentary about her son. And she had a heart attack early that morning. She was on her way. And she said it in our play, and she said it in our first interview. She said, I realized when they found my son's body on September 1st, 1955, that I was going to be spending the rest of my life fighting this thing, fighting for justice, fighting for Emmett until the day I die. And that is exactly what happened. So, yeah, she would have been right down there with Trayvon Martin and all his supporters and all of the family. She would have been just right there, right in the thick of all of it.
What do you think she would have said about the interview that I did, like one with Mr. Fabian, Dante Scott, in Beaumont, Texas? What do you think she would have said?
Well, first, she would have wanted to hear all of them before she made a comment. She was a school teacher now, so she wanted to make sure they had all the information. I mean, literally, she would take the test, and she would grade the thing. It was so funny. The first script I gave her, Ms. Mobley had in the old days, you had the red marking pen, right? So she had the red marking pen on things in the big script to make sure that, is this right? Is this right? We're going to phrase this right? Okay, what are we saying here? I mean, she would have been meticulous about it. But one of the things that she would have done before listening to your interviews is she would have wanted to make sure that she read up on everything about the case that she could read. But I tell you, I can tell you straight up, one of the things that she'd be proudest of is that those interviews were being conducted by a black woman. Now, I want you to think about that now. In her day, all the press pool, with very little exception, the general press pool were white men. Unless she called the defender, Chicago Defender, or Jet, or Negro Digest, or Ebony, they weren't coming. So we were covered in our stuff, and they covered her in their stuff. But very rarely were there any women. That's why she bonded so well with some of the female reporters from Ebony and Jet, because Mr. Johnson, yet again, a groundbreaker and a trailblazer and a trendsetter, he had several African-American women in his press pool. And she bonded with them immediately. And there were several in the Defender as well. But Johnny's Johnson started that trend. So she would be proudest that there's a sister out here doing serious interviews about serious topics on serious subject matters and who ain't scared, you know, who's not afraid to bring the message to the people.
Okay?
She would be honored. As a matter of fact, she'd take your call before she'd take my call or somebody else's call, Black Man's, because she'd like to say, first of all, just, you know, how happy she was for you. What can she do to help continue to move your stuff forward? That's what she'd be doing. So she'd first be proud that as a woman who's had like a decade plus of legacy and a track record of doing these kinds of things, that would have really made her proud, sister.
I've been doing this for over 15 years.
Yeah.
I couldn't get a job in journalism. I didn't like Donald Trump ran for president because he didn't like the way things were going here in America. He didn't like there being a Black president. He didn't like Black people.
Nope.
I didn't like the way the racism was going. I didn't like all the killings. I didn't like what I was seeing on the news. I didn't like the decades of my life where I have been discriminated against.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I started the Queen of Show Talk, Angela Butler, and I started the Angela Butler Show with Tracy Wingfield. That was the first show. The Angela Butler Show's with Miss Tracy Wingfield. The Queen of Show Talk, Angela Butler. I went out on my own. And Show Talk with Angela Butler, I went out on my own.
When she started, and a lot of people don't know this, the Emmett Till case was right next to the Rosenberg case, you know, the two Jewish the Jewish couple who were accused of espionage. Those were the two first televised trials in American television history. A lot of people don't even know that. But when you look at that trial, okay, look very carefully. You don't see any Black female reporters out there. That's not saying they weren't there. One or two from Ebony, ironically enough. And I cannot believe I can't remember what her name is, but an incredible reporter and who I actually met once. But she was one. And remember now, this is a trial that's covered all over the world, but you have, and a Black mother is out there crying for all the world to see, but she's got nobody to talk to in the press pool who can even understand or remotely relate to what her pain is at that moment. And now look where we are. So she would be thrilled to listen to your stuff. Let's put it this way. You'd have her, you know, she'd be on your follows. Okay, she'd have you in the likes. She'd be one of your biggest followers. She would have the Name It to a Mobley Foundation right up there supporting you, saying, you watch that, you listen to Angela Butler. Anytime I tell you to, she would be right behind you on that, okay? I'm
telling you. But if you think of President Obama.
Well, when she was
Black president.
Yeah, right before she passed, I want to say Barack Obama had run for the state Senate, and he was about to run for the Senate, you know, but she passed. She passed before he could become elected in 2004. But I can tell you this. She was a big supporter of our African-American politicians in and around south and west sides of Chicago. Because you got to remember, when she was growing up there, you know, we didn't have a lot of representation. We could vote. I mean, they could vote to a certain extent, but they could only, because it was a machine politics stuff. Anybody that they put out there was really just a puppet from the city hall. And one of the major mayors there, Richard Daley, not the son but the old man, is one of the old school mob politicians at that particular point. It's part of a machine thing. So the politics in the city of Chicago, really anything that ever benefited us. She didn't start seeing the benefits of local politicians, or even though just on a national level, until much later in her life. But had she just, if we could have just got another 5 years out of her, for her to be able to be alive, to look in her city, Grant Park, and watch that Black man walk out there with those beautiful women on his arm, his wife, and those adorable children, as the new president of the United States in November 2008, it would have made her heart sail up as bigger than the full moon, okay? Because she would have felt that was a job well done. to her felt that that was a job well done. She loved articulate, beautiful-looking black people. She loved the people, but she loved their accomplishment. But more than anything, though, she loved their inspiration to lead to other Baracks, to other Michelles, to other Angela Butlers, to all these other folks, because her thing was building blocks, building blocks, building blocks. This leads to this, and this leads to this, and this leads to that. That's what she was all about. That's what she was all about.
All right. All right. So what do you think about President Barack Obama, and what do you think about what Mr. Biden has did with the monuments?
Well, I can tell you what, you know, just on a grand scale, sadly, you know, and gladly, but sadly, the last guy that was in the White House is making his predecessor, who was Barack, look like FDR and Abraham Lincoln rolled up into one, quite frankly. It's a shame that his first, Barack Obama's first administration, was mired in fighting against a raging tide, things that should have been no-brainers. But I'll tell you a little piece of the stuff that everybody in Chicago understands and remembers well, that people around the country might not know. President Obama was part of the Harold Washington campaign when he first got to Chicago in 85, and Harold Washington was the first, his reelection campaign, and Harold Washington was the first black man in Chicago, and he ran up against very, very, very similar obstructionism throughout his city council. It so much so that it made his first term almost negligible because he was constantly fighting ignorance and obstructionism and racism and marginalization, just like Obama did in his first term. So for us in Illinois, it was, you know, deja vu all over again. And I am so sorry, because some of those things with the majority in the House and the Senate and SCOTUS, he could have really gotten some things done, and he couldn't. He couldn't because he was actually trying to work her hands across the aisle. And if he was like the last guy that was in the White House, he would have just ramrodded all of that stuff right on through. But he also had, remember the Blue Dog Democrats? He had people from his own party not supporting him.
So okay? You know President Barack Obama?
Oh, I met him a couple times in Illinois, yes. And and his wife was very good friends with my publisher at the time when Mr. Johnson passed. She was very, very tight with Linda Johnson Rice and several other people. So I've been in a room with him a couple times. As a matter of fact, a lot of people don't know. His first national interview after he became president, the first national interview he did, look it up, was Ebony Magazine. Okay? When it was announced that he was a president, he walked in front of Grant Park with those throngs and throngs of people. Johnson Publishing Company was directly across Grant Park at the time. He walked, he jumped in the motorcade. He spent the night at the Hilton Hotel. The next morning, he walked down the street to 820 South Michigan Avenue and did a photo shoot. And his first interview was with Ebony Magazine at Johnson Publishing. Okay? So we're very familiar.
Keep talking. It'll go.
Well, just so you know, we're very familiar. We were very familiar with the Obamas in Illinois, and they're back, of course, doing wonderful things there. But I wish his first term wasn't mired with so much obstructionism or trying to placate folks, you know, that you're never going to win over, okay? And it's amazing because he was part of, like I said, Harold Washington's reelection campaign. You would thought he would have remembered that. You would have thought he would remember that, but he didn't. He didn't. And he was able to get some things done in the second term, but, you know, just the fact that you have so much obstructionism, I don't know how good he could have been if he had had more cooperation from members of his own party. I'm not even trying to win over the other folks, but even your own party, people that you say, these are things you say you believe in, he had to fight them. For a good chunk of his administration.
The Democrats didn't work with President Barack Obama.
A good chunk of them didn't. A good chunk of them didn't. And they wound up paying for it with their jobs. Okay? New York Times just released their top presidents in the history of the United States, and Obama's number 7. Okay? guess where the last guy was that was in prison, that was in the White House? Okay, guess what number he is out of 45. But he's the leader of the Republican nomination right now.
President Trump.
Yes. He's number 45 out of 45. That's from the New York Times. Biden's at 14. I just wish that there were more open faced. First of all, the presidency has been so watered down and weakened for decades and decades now. So now what folks have done is they've just gone totally around the Constitution, do unconstitutional things. Had he done any of that stuff, he would have been impeached successfully. Successfully. Okay, so, you know, I'm looking for, because he's a young man still, I'm looking forward to see what he's going to do with his philanthropic endeavors through the years, he and Michelle. I'm looking forward to that. And, you know, the children are very young, too.
You looking to see what President Barack Obama does, what former president?
With his philanthropic events. I would like, he's got the new library that's in the heart of the South Side of Chicago, which is going to be incredible. With his books and the tours and the podcast, you know, he and his wife are successful movie producers right now, really putting out some incredible documentaries right now and supporting some wonderful works. Yeah, he and Michelle Obama are going to have an entirely different second life, just like Jimmy Carter did. Jimmy Carter did 10 times more as the ex-president than he ever did as a president. There's a reason why he won that vote.
Was on television. My brother's keeper was on NBC. Now, I don't have cable.
Okay.
I can't afford cable.
Okay.
But I have internet, and I was watching them talk about my brother's keeper.
Well, there you go.
He's finally getting credit.
I'm sorry, say that again?
He's finally getting credit for my brother's keeper and the great work in organizations and companies and things that have come out of my brother's keeper.
Mm-hmm.
And all the thousands of young black men, thousands of young black men that have been helped in this country from my brother's keeper in this country, all the way to Wisconsin. Hello, sir. Hello, sir. Can we finish the interview? A couple of moments.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. So I mean, I got a few more minutes. Yeah.
Just finish. Two more minutes.
Okay.
I just wanted to know, like I was saying, President Barack Obama is getting credit for my brother's keeper. I think you are a great man, Mr. David Barr III. You, Mr. Hollins, all of you, a great man. And I thank you for gracing Show Talk with Angela Butler.
You're doing God's work out here, sister. Thank you. Thank you for continuing to bring this word to the people, and thank you for it. It's been an honor. I absolutely love what you're doing. I'm a big supporter. You got a big new fan here. Okay. Keep on doing God's work out here, sister.
Thank you, sir.
Okay.
All right, everyone. You just got to listen, Mr. David Barr III. Mr. David Barr III is a notable playwright. He worked for Ebony Magazine for over 20 years. He knew Mr. Emmett Till's mother, Miss Mamie Mobley Till. I thank Mr. Hollins for introducing me to Mr. David Barr. Thank you all for listening to Show Talk with Angela Butler. Once again, Mr. David Barr III is a great man. He's did numerous playwrights. I did not go into detail about all the plays that he has did, but you can research him, Mr. David Barr III. He's did numerous plays. He's working on a play now, and he's still working. He's still working in advertisement and marketing. And working on plays is he just received the award in 2022. So I thank you all for listening to Show Talk with Angela Butler.